The DeFalco Files is an entertainment-based program. Some memories of certain events might be fuzzy. All opinions are that of the host. Content might not be appropriate for children and some adults. Listener discretion is advised. And remember, the truth is here. Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting presents The DeFalco Files with FSW owner Joe DeFalco and your host, Matt Michaels.
Hey everybody, it's Matt Michaels here, and I once again am joined for The DeFalco Files by the guy it's named after, the man, the myth, the legend, Joe DeFalco. Joe, how are you doing, man?
Doing wonderful. Right now I'm at the FSW training facility. We got a kids class summer camp going on with Chris Bay, the next X Division champion, running it for the kids.
That's awesome. And I'll tell you right now, if you're listening and you have any kids who are interested in wrestling, you're in the Vegas area, please, please look at FSW for kids classes, because there's nowhere else in the country where you get guys like Chris Bay rolling around with your kids and training them a little bit. That's amazing.
Right. We should be charging extra for that.
Yeah. And speaking about rolling around in the ring and training, today, Joe, you've got a very special guest joining you. The man who we hope very soon will become part of a podcast that you guys will do called The Fourth Wall. Right? Fourth Wall? Is that what you're playing around with?
Well, yeah, but, you know, it could be wrestling over sushi. You know what I mean? never met a guy who likes sushi more than, you know, I knew my kid loves sushi, but I think Tom has a beat.
Well, yes, that's how we arrange the training is he pays me in sushi.
Well, if anyone who's listening doesn't know, Tom Howard is one of the, I guess the best word to describe it, most respected trainers / wrestlers, because Tom had a very lengthy and wonderful career out there. He's one of the best around. All truth disclosed, I've said it many times before, but when I wrestled learning training, it was Tom Howard who was one of my, well, he was the head instructor at UPW in Southern California. And I just want to say before we start, Tom, you know, for as many teachers throughout my life that I've had, you are one of those people who I would call one of my top three influences in life, because you just are so smart with what you see and what you do. And it's no smoke up your ass, but it's really truthfully from my heart that you've, you know, influenced my life. And I appreciate that 100%.
Thank you so much. That means way more than you could ever imagine.
And, you know, me growing up, you know, Tom was a big influence for me when I was a little kid when he was training over at UPW. You know, I said, man, someday I'd love to do some of the things that Tom did when I was a little pipsqueak back in the day.
That's right. Tom trained Stanislav Zbysko back in 1892, I think it was.
Yes.
So just so listeners get to know a little bit about you, Tom, when did you start training and with who did you actually start training under?
Yeah, so I started in the mid-90s, early 90s under Jesse Hernandez and Bill Anderson at the time at a place called School of Hard Knocks. Kind of a fun story about that. This is kind of pre-internet. So I was at a gym and I saw this giant mountain of a man doing squats. And I said, this guy's got to be someone famous. So I finally ended up talking to him. It turns out his name is Hank Hill. And I asked him, what does he do? Why is he so big? He said he's a pro wrestler. Well, it turns out he'd only trained one time to be a pro wrestler, but that was his
Okay, we're back. I think.
You there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
What's the last thing you heard? What's the last thing you heard, Matt?
That Hank wasn't a pro wrestler, I think it was, or only had one match. Uh-oh.
As you said, the early connections.
Damn it. And I can hear everything you guys are saying. You can't hear me. Okay.
No, we can hear you now. Oh, okay. We can hear you.
Damn. All right, so...
Tell me the last word you heard, and I'll jump right back in.
That Hank was only had, like, one match?
Yes. So Hank Hill had only trained one time, but he couldn't remember where the wrestling school was. So we run into an old-time wrestler named Al Burke, Mr. Outrageous. He agrees to meet us and take us to the pro wrestling school. So we finally find this wrestling school, and it was Bill Anderson, Jesse Hernandez, School of Hard Knocks in the ghetto of San Bernardino, California.
Al Burke, I didn't know him. He's up in Alaska now, right?
No, he's in L.A.
Oh, is he now?
Yeah.
He was there for a while, right?
He was in Alaska. He's a character actor. He plays a cop in just about everything you can imagine.
He trained up there with a guy I know, Nick Danger.
Yes, he was an Alaska guy.
Yes.
Anyway, so the story from there was trained with them for 2 years, basically, pretty intense, and then had an opportunity to start wrestling out here in Las Vegas for a promotion called NWC over at the Silver Nugget. And eventually, Jesse Hernandez would set up the ring for WWE and for WWF at the time and for AAA Lucha Libre. And so got to go backstage and meet all the guys at both. One point at the AAA show, they had a big one at the LA Sports Arena. The owner, Antonio Pena, walked by. Jesse says, hey, you got to check out my guy. He says some stuff to him in Spanish. Next thing I know, I jump in the ring. I hand him my promo pictures, and I get a call about a month later from Conan. And he says, hey, we'd like you to come down. This is on a Monday. He says, we'd like you to come down to Mexico for an angle we're running, Mexico contra El Mundo. I was playing a Russian character, KGB. And they had a Samu Fatu, who is Rikishi's brother. He was playing a sumo wrestler. And they had a Mexican under a mask named Killer with Andy Barrow. So we had a fake Russian. We had a Samoan sumo wrestler and a Mexican under a mask playing the American. So the funny part is I had a full 9-to-5 job during this point, and I had the basically given about 5 days' notice. I had to get my passport pulled together, which I had to do urgently, and tell my boss I was leaving. I said, Conan, how long am I going to be there for? He said, if the fans like you, then you can stay as long as you want. If they don't like you, then we'll probably ship you home on the following Monday. So I went down there on that Friday, got picked up at the airport from a guy from Tijuana who spoke really good English, a young kid. Turns out, I said, what's your name? What do you do? He says, my uncle's Rey Mysterio Sr. He says, I'm going to go by the wrestling name Rey Mysterio Jr. As, you know,
I think I heard of him.
I know. I heard him once or twice. And I got thrown into the to the wolves with the lions, whatever the expression is. And one of the funny parts about that, so I get there, I go to do the match. I don't understand how Lucha Libre works. I didn't realize they had 60-minute matches. So I went out there and got blown up so badly, and that was my introduction to Mexico.
And you went on to have a very a known career in Mexico. And then was it 96 that you hooked up with Rick Bassman?
Yeah. So the folks in Mexico did another show back in the States. I stayed there the entire time in Mexico City. It was getting pretty burnt out. I came back to the States to do the show here. It turned out that Rick Bassman had opened a gym called Extreme University. They had a wrestling ring set up. That's where I first met Chavo Guerrero. Chavo and I were started helping teach wrestling there. Back in the day, this was when a lot of the UFC fighters were, Mark Coleman, Kevin Randleman, Mark Kerr. They were all training there as Rick Bassman managed them, and they all were trying to get into pro wrestling because the UFC was potentially going to be banned. Right. So we primarily trained those guys, and then we started slowly but surely bringing in students. One of our first students was Aaron Aguilera, who went on to wrestle as Jesus Aguilera, I believe.
Hardcore Kid, Alcatraz's partner.
Yep. And then Sylvester Chokai, who I believe wrestled as Sylvester Chokai. He was in Japan with me as the hell in Japan was it? Predator. We started there. That school, that gym ended up shutting down, and we moved to Huntington Beach. And I believe that's where you started training with us, right, Huntington?
Yeah.
Yeah, and LA Boxing.
Yeah. And that
We started doing these weekly shows, basically just student showcases, and that progressed into one of our friends. Rick Bastman's a magician. He somehow knows how to make things work. And one of our friends had this place called the Galaxy Concert Theater, and we worked a deal out. So it was like a dinner theater that we had the place to put a ring. So we worked a deal out there and slowly but surely started doing shows that were selling out at the Galaxy. We started filming those, and that drew the attention of the WWE. Oh, okay. In the meantime, my partner Hank Hill and I, Rick Bastman wanted us to pitch us to WWE. So they brought us out for a tryout match, a dark match. They ended up signing me, but they didn't sign Hank because at the time he was a jack bodybuilder, and I think they were trying to keep steroids off TV. So they signed me, and then once we got to a certain level with the WWE, they began paying us a weekly salary as basically a development territory, and they kept me on. I had to go on the road to do dark matches, primarily against Kurt Angle and a couple of other guys that were in development, and then come home and teach. And that's the beginning of UPW.
Yeah, it's a great little story. Now, Joe, at this point in your career, you're still doing radio stuff. Were you aware of UPW and what was happening in Southern California?
It depends on what time frame we're looking at, because we started running some shows at Rush's old wrestling school probably around 99.
Okay.
And through some of our people, one guy was from Chicago, so he was buddies with Ace Steele. The other guy, Jack and Boom Boom Kamini, they were from APW, so that was the Modest connection.
Right.
So, and then I had made a connection with Navajo Warrior because we were looking at rings at the time if we had to rent them. So when we did our first Vegas Extreme show, it ended up being like if you used you went to the UPW website, because yes, we were very aware of UPW, and they had certain crews that came in, which was the Pro Wrestling Iron crew, which was Modest and Morgan, Donovan Morgan, and a couple others. And then at that point, we became friends with Derek Nykirk, and when he moved back to Arizona, we gave him Navajo's number, where he ended up hooking up with Mike Knox. So Nykirk and Knox and Navajo, so that was probably after we did what we were doing.
Yeah.
Because Nykirk didn't know Knox. He was in HWA, which was Les Thatcher's place in Cincinnati. But it's just crazy, you know, Gallo and Knox and Modest and all the guys that ended up going through FSW and UPW. It's like a huge amount. And I remember meeting Tom once back at the old school on Boulder Highway because, you know, he was tight with Alcatraz. And at that point, Alcatraz was probably our heavyweight champion at that time. So it's kind of come full circle to where, you know, Tom's here now. You know, he's trained our women's champion, Lacey Ryan. And it's like, seems like now he's back in the business.
With the experience you have, Tom, in making relationships that last. I think this is kind of an important thing for anyone who is looking to, you know, build their career. What was your personal secret? Because there's a couple guys like you, Chris Daniels, Navajo. If you talk to anyone, there's never been a bad word. You know, I can't find a person who goes, oh yeah, Tom Howard, what a dick, you know? What has been your formula for keeping good relationships, even though sometimes you might walk into a locker room and you might think, oh God, that guy's fucking insane, or, you know, what the hell am I doing in this place? What keeps you, what do you do to make sure your relationships stay solid?
So from the get-go, I understood the difference when people were training, that not everyone thought they were going to be a big star. For some people, they were happy just to be there in practice. For some people, they were super excited just to be a part of the show. So I try to treat everyone as I'd like to be treated, obviously, and be respectful of the fact that they're, you know, everyone has a different background. Not everyone's the same athletically or whatever else. So that's probably it. I have an interesting background. I was raised as a Mormon with seven brothers and sisters in Salt Lake City, Utah. So, you know, I came up in a very religious setting where you try to be a Christian. And so obviously I'm not a Mormon anymore, but that, I think, was ingrained in me so heavily. And with the siblings around all the time, you kind of just treat everyone like they're one of your brothers or sisters.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Joe, what value does a person like Tom bring to your school, which is already has a, you know, a huge lineup of names? What do you see in Tom that you've, you know, noticed already with students and with his methods?
You know, the thing is, you never, it's like, you know, a good baseball team, a good football team, you never have enough talent. And, you know, in the past, if Sin Bodie or Kenny King or D'Lo Brown couldn't make it, as good as our young guys are, like Damian Drakes and Remy Marcells and stuff like that, when you're trying to bring new students in, you need to have a track record. You know, when we talk to people who just contact us a lot of times from out of state or whatever, and they think maybe they want to try it out, maybe they're going to move to Vegas, you know, I always try to give some advice to these younger guys. And it's like, you know, you need to try to go to a school where the people involved have actually done something in the business. And, you know, having a guy who wrestles locally in front of 75 people is probably not going to be the guy that's going to help you get to where you want to go. Because, number one, it's extremely difficult to be seen to begin with. Right. You know, FSW, we're in a great position because we got D'Lo, who is talent relations at Impact. We got Kenny King, who has helped numerous guys get on the Ring of Honor shows, you know, and, you know, AEW, when they came out here, you know, Chris Bay got signed on Impact because Sanjay Dutt, who worked with us, was an agent, saw Chris, and they needed somebody for a dark match, and they gave it to Chris, even though nobody knew who he was other than Sanjay, to, like, give that match to him. He got the match, and then Impact all of a sudden very quickly offered Chris a contract.
Right.
And to have that ability, and the fact is, I've known the name Tom Howard for many, many years. I met him once briefly. You know, he might have even been drunk that day.
Sure was.
You know, but I saw what he did. And the thing is, the fact that he's trained Samoa Joe and The Miz and Cena and all these guys, that doesn't really mean anything until you actually see what he does in there. And it's like the knowledge, I love knowledge. Like at seminars, even though I never wrestled and I'm a fan, I always love listening to whether it's a story or just information that's being put out. And Tom is very, very, very hands-on. Like I saw more about his training when we were closed, when we would have like – he'd have Lacey come in and – she needed somebody to roll around with, and Damian Drake and Vandergriff always were the guys that come to this day. They train more than probably all our students combined because they have a goal, and their goal isn't to be the Saturday night superstar in Las Vegas. Their goal is to be the best wrestler in the world. You know, that's great. Lacey having a moniker, I always say, oh, she's the best unsigned. Well, that's not a great moniker to be the best unsigned talent. you want to be signed. Yeah. You know, there's a big difference in pay between being unsigned and being signed. You know, look at Tessa Blanchard. Probably 2 years ago, she probably barely could make $100 working on a show. She's been anointed as the best women's wrestler, and now she commands whatever she wants, and you know, she can tell Impact, you know what, that's not enough money for me to come in from Mexico to put over somebody.
Yeah.
And it's hard work. And despite the fact that Tom's been out of it, you would never know that he really hasn't been like hands-on with a bunch of other people besides Lacey, because you just sit there for 5 minutes and it's like, wow, this is amazing. You know, he's buddies with Marty Elias, the referee. Marty's been in town for a week or two. And I always was like the first to tell you that a great referee really differentiates himself from a regular referee. And I thought we had one or two decent, you know, to really good refs. But just watching Marty in there, it's a whole new ball game. So with Marty Elias, you know, he's inside the ring. He's literally a third wrestler in the ring.
Yeah.
You know, at a place where the positioning is, the camera. It's like, it's amazing how much more a really good referee can learn. You know, it isn't a farce when you say you never stop learning. You know, there's so much more people can do. Like at FSW, as good as we are, I'm never happy or content with anything we ever do. A show could be really good, but it still could be better. So it's like having the guys that we have on hand, you know, TJ Perkins, Daivari, it's like if they're available, I'm going to try to see if we can use them, because it's also good to hear the same thing from seven people instead of two.
Yeah.
You know, kids are pretty thick-headed these days. And besides being delusional, so maybe the more it gets beaten into their heads, they might actually believe what you're telling them.
Is that something, Tom, that you've seen in the difference between, you know, going all the way back to 96, so about, you know, 25 years almost, in the difference between when you got into it and you were first teaching, it was about the business, learning chain wrestling, learning this. Like, if you got into wrestling, you really wanted to learn it. Whereas nowadays, you get people who just want to become stars right away. This is kind of the same thing in the entertainment industry. Instead of putting in the work, they just want the rewards. Do you see a lot of that?
I don't so much see it. I know it's easy to jump on the bandwagon and talk about kids being snowflakes or participation trophies. I think that if you give them a good foundation, for example, when I started working with some of the younger kids here, or the younger talents here, sometimes they just hadn't explained to them that the correct answer is yes, sir, or no, sir. And you're not give your opinion, that you need to keep your ears open, your mouth closed in the beginning. And it's like the military, there's a hierarchy. And once they understand that, then they're quick to appreciate it, but they just had to have it explained. I'm not hardcore that way, but I could tell the people who understood and who didn't. And once they understood it, then they're willing to put in the work. So as long as you give them a framework, you know, like I said before, not everyone's here thinking they're going to be the next world champion. A good portion of them are here just to chase a dream and become the best version of themselves they can be.
With that, let's kind of look at some of the guys that you've had contact with in UPW that have gone on through Joe's circuit at FSW. Joe, who is the first person that you can think of off the top of your head that you know came from Tom's training that you worked with?
Well, training wise, it was a little different than bringing in the guys like Modest's crew,
right?
Because in UPW, they kind of ran like almost like faction angles based off the companies that they were a part of,
right?
So very early on, you know, in our very beginning, we used Navajo and Knox and Nykirk. And we didn't use Modest till 2009, but we had used a bunch of his students. and stuff like that. But we were always aware. We had a couple of our guys that actually worked some of their shows, the Riggs brothers, Dylan Klein, who went into – they both signed in developmental. But you always kept track of guys in UPW, even the younger students. I remember there was a guy named Sabbath that had a great look, and it was like when we were trying to look to do bigger shows – at that point, you would look at UPW because you knew the foundation of those guys.
Right.
Because you also, at that point, you knew a John Cena, but you also knew they were running shows and then they became developmental. I remember the first thing was like, wow, they got Kevin Nash and Scott Hall on a show. And then it was the Hardy Brothers. Yeah. And then it was Rob Van Dam. And it was like, wow, this is amazing. That right here in California, because developmental was always in Kentucky, it was in Cincinnati, you know, it was in Georgia. And it was like the West Coast really didn't get a lot of coverage when it came to the independent wrestling back in the day. There might have been that one company in SoCal, Rev Pro, which kind of became the precursor to PWG. Right. But back then, PWG didn't exist.
Right.
You know, UPW was the be-all, end-all. You know, most indie shows to this day in California are drawing 40 people, 60 people. And, you know, I remember it was like you would just go online and you would check and be like, oh, the Galaxy Theater, I believe it had like bar tops. And you'd sit around and it was like, you know, it was amazing. Like, oh, is this place really going to draw? And it was always packed.
Yep.
Because, you know, the talent alone wasn't just the WWF guys. It was the fact that John Heidenreich and Nathan Jones and all these other guys that you don't think of as huge superstars, but it's like there had to be 20, 30 guys that came out of that school that went on. And I'm not talking about the Mike Modis who were already established. I'm talking about guys who pretty much started there or their foundation was in UPW. You know, Jesse Hernandez has a good reputation, School of Hard Knocks, but in – such a short time, I think UPW probably produced more major league wrestlers to this day than any company or any wrestling school has. So it's like, you know, that's a high bar to set. Like, you know, one day I'd love to say, man, we signed half as many guys as UPW, and I think we would have done really well. You know, maybe it was a different time. Maybe it was, you know, big muscly guys, Southern California, great looks. You know, it became an easy target to find people. And I guess it became probably a lot easier, Tom would know, of getting people to come into the school because of the reputation they built. It's kind of like what we're trying to do in here in FSW. By having all these people that come in here that have been part of WWF, WCW, Ring of Honor, Impact, AEW, you know, our trainers have a couple hundred years of, you know, of background and experience. Like, how can you go anywhere in this town and not want to come to FSW first?
Right.
It boggles my mind. I know the answer because some people want to be stars a lot quicker, and it's a lot easier to be the big fish in the small pond. While we've seen even with the old schools in the back, like Adrenaline, where some guys were afraid to leave there because they would have to prove themselves, start at the bottom, and work their way up. And we've had numerous guys who eventually came over, like a Thomas Day, who was extremely talented. And he became a No Limits champion. But he was secure in being the top guy there because he'd get the really good matches. Well, in FSW, it was an unknown market, to, you know, because also, hey, you don't want to go over there. They know you came from here. They're going to treat you like shit. They're going to bury you. And that was the first thing when Tyshawn Prince came over, that even in our inner circle, it was kind of like, oh, we need to humble this 6'7", 350-pound monster. It was like, so we're going to have him job out in the first match, but then make him a star. It's like you can only make him a monster the first time people see you.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, you know, everything we try to do is to – get people to the next level. You know, our beginner students, they get to go to Ring of Honor and Impact and get to see how a weekly television show is produced. Even though we do it at a smaller level, they get to be a part of that by coming to FSW. So again, why anybody goes anywhere else, I'm clueless.
let's talk a little bit about some stories, Tom. I'll throw some names at you. First name I'll throw out there is Alcatraz. What is your, I mean, you guys just met up like a couple weeks ago at FSW. What has your relationship been with Alcatraz, and what is maybe one of the more standout stories you have about him?
Well, so Al's a good brother. We've known him for forever. And he was in San Diego, and he would come up and wrestle for us, part of a group called Team Hardcore with Aaron Aguilera.
And the Jefe.
And El Jefe, of course. Yeah. Yes, El Jefe. That's Aaron's shoot father. And so they came out in like prison garb, like they were escaped prisoners, basically. Anyway, they both ended up working in Japan with me, brought them over there for 01. So a lot of fun stories from Japan. But the one funny story is so we got involved in casting and production as well for Hollywood. And Rick Bassman and I were, at the time, Rick agent. And so we brought all the guys in and got headshots done on them and started casting them in different productions and things. So there was a commercial for Snapple. And Alcatraz, if anyone knows what he looks like, covered in tattoos. He had a long...
The ponytail?
Yeah, like a rat tail in the back. Yeah. I mean, it just looked like the scary guy you wouldn't want to have to do time with. So, this is the picture. So, so in my haste, I read the casting for Snapple for prison. I didn't catch that it was a prison guard. And so I thought it was prisoner. So... He drove from San Diego 3 hours and then had to wait for 2 hours in a, basically a cattle call. And then he went in and he says, I'm here for the prisoner. And they said, this is for prison guard. So he read for it and then he called me immediately after. And he said, what are you doing sending me on the audition for prison guard for? And I said, oh, no, I feel so horrible. But anyway, just funny stories, in Japan. We already are pretty scary when we're over there walking around. I don't need to tell you we stand out like sore thumb. Nathan Jones, John Heidenreich. So walking around with Alcatraz, who is one of the sweetest guys you will ever meet. He'll give you the shirt off his back, but he looks so incredibly scary. You saw people literally crossing the streets to not have to go around, to be by us in Japan.
Wow.
Did he like sushi?
Yes. you don't have a choice. In Japan, you must learn to like sushi. And it's not good sushi there. It's all sashimi and nigiri. They don't do any American rolls. That's like an American thing.
Ah, I did not know that.
I know.
See, that's why wrestling over sushi.
Right?
one person that I know that you were very close to, what's your fondest memory of Sean O'Hare?
Sean O'Hare, very interesting guy. He became my brother-in-law. He moved out. Rick and I had I had a beach house at the time, and then Rick had rented the park next to my place. And Sean came out to see us to do some stuff for UPW. Basically, well, let me take it back just a minute here so you understand, because when you were asking about why UPW became what it became, it was very simple. It was the timing of the fact that we were under contract with WWE for development. Rick was already well known by the fitness industry. So we had guys like, let's say, Aaron Baker, who's a pretty famous bodybuilder. He was with the WBF. So when he reached out to want to get into wrestling, they sent him to Rick. And then he tells all the guys at Gold's Gym about UPW, the wrestling school. So we got all these famous, Paul Dillett, Chris Cormier, they all decide they're going to come train to be pro wrestlers, which was a train wreck to watch. But nice enough guys. And then, of course, at Gold's Gym, you had a young guy that worked making smoothies, and he decides he wants to come down and be a pro wrestler. His name was John Cena. And if you remember the old documentary on Discovery Channel, you see... John Cena's path. So that's kind of how it progressed, because once these people got involved, then they told their friends. We also had a guy, or have a guy, named Barry Bloom. He's the manager or agent for a lot of the biggest names in the business, has been forever. So, for example, at one point, Hall and Nash were talking about coming back to WWE. And so Bloom says, let's go do a match. They wanted to prove that they could work together and basically just put something on tape to go show Vince again. So Bloom brings him down, and it's myself and Christopher Daniels. We get to wrestle Hall and Nash at a UPW show, if you can imagine that. I believe it was their last ever tag team match. And, the crazy part is they were kind of known maybe to have a bit of an attitude in WWE or WCW, but they wanted to prove that they were very humble. So they agreed to not just have one of them job and take the pin, but they agreed to have them both be pinned by us both at the same time, which was just a remarkable thing to be a part of. So anyway, like I said, so that just progressed. Then you had, Triple H come down and he'd do a promo in ring, and then we had Vince McMahon cut a promo and send it for the big screen. So, we had to do reports on the talent on a weekly basis. And then they'd send them off to do dark matches and start signing them to development. So Sean O'Hare, getting back to that, he was one of the guys that had left Vince and wanted to try to make his way back. So he came out. It pretty much became known as, if you wanted to get in there, that's one of the main ways to do it, is come to UPW. So he came and moved in to our guest place, and he met my sister-in-law, and they got married. So Sean O'Hare was my brother-in-law, actually. And very interesting guy, really, really smart, really, really nice, very sharp. But he had a mean streak in him. So about half the nights we went out, Sean O'Hare, he hated bullies. And so if he saw someone, yelling at people or bullying people, you end up drunk in bars, he'd end up knocking him out. And it became like he would never knock out a guy who didn't have it coming.
Yeah.
But he was like the superhero who knocked out the bully every other night. And the problem is he's 6'5" with tattoos on his hands of spider webs and stuff, so he's pretty easy to recognize. So he eventually got himself in some legal problems, and I think that's what led to his demise and eventually, unfortunately, taking his own life.
Yeah.
Definitely. He was one of my favorite wrestlers.
Oh, I know.
I'm like, man, this guy had it all.
He had everything.
It was really disappointing to see when they put him with Piper in WWE, and he was like he was the devil on the shoulder and stuff, and that got over pretty good, and they just didn't, sometimes you look at certain guys and say, man, that's a guy Vince McMahon can do a lot with. Mm-hmm. And Sean O'Hare was one of the guys that I looked at and said, man, this guy could be the champion. Mm-hmm. But maybe because of the inner demons and all the other stuff, that he never got that push that you would think that he was deserving of, because him and Jindrak in WCW were great together.
Yeah.
And I wasn't that big a fan of Jindrak, so it was all O'Hare.
Sean also was a guy who loved mixed martial arts and fighting, as did I. And so he always saw himself as a fighter that was doing pro wrestling rather than a pro wrestling fan. And then, of course, we did get to do fighting together. He was with Pride and K1. And so I fought with him in Japan quite a few times. We had similar records in that we did more losing.
Not
a lot of wins in the category. But the tough part is it's two parts are interesting there that I tell people. Number one, everyone else who works their way up to Pride, K1, UFC, they had to fight their way to get there. And you have to have a 10 to 15 to 20 and 0 or whatever record. We were pro wrestlers. They had no fights. And then you also come from a place where you are used to throwing work punches. And it's no matter how – first of all, you got to get out there and fight when you're not angry at the person. And you're in this giant arena looking up this giant Titantron type deal. And you'll find yourself pulling punches in real fights because your body's conditioned to do it. Sean and I would joke about that because it's really hard to connect when your body's used to pulling.
I look at kind of the opposite way because – we've had some UFC guys.
Yes.
Phil Baroni, Stefan Bonner, Frank Mir. And the problem is they're either too light or they're too stiff.
Yeah.
So Baroni was way too stiff. He didn't give a fuck. Like, get out of the way if I'm going to punch you in the face.
Yeah.
Bonner would be the polar opposite depending on the day. Like, he'd be stiff as can be, and then some days it'd be like, what are you doing? You're throwing punches like a girl. Because now he's trying to overcompensate because people are saying you're too stiff.
Yeah. Greatness.
And when you so it probably is even more difficult when you're kind of doing both at the same time. Like, a lot of times in the past it was they left, you know, Shamrock left UFC and he just wrestled for a long time.
Right.
And then as things progressed, guys were still doing both at the same time. Tom Lawler, Mizani, who works for us, the same thing. Like Tom's wrestling full time, but he couldn't do one of our shows because he was going to be doing an MMA fight. So it's like, do you get hit in the head and then forget what you're doing? Right. Like, hey, am I in a wrestling match or am I in an MMA fight?
Yeah,
so,
very true.
Just interesting things to contemplate.
Yeah, with the transitions of UFC guys into wrestling and vice versa, to both of you guys, who sticks out to you who have made the transitions? I mean, outside of, you know, Lesnar going into UFC, is there any guys that stick out to you that maybe, Tom, you've worked with or trained, or Joe, that you've used that you think are just, you know, the tits, the, you know, just amazing?
Well, I'll go with a guy that was in the UFC. They ended up just not using him. He had a couple of fights. So I guess he trained to wrestle before the UFC, which is Tom Lawler. And Tom lives in Vegas, and a couple guys knew him. They're like, hey, is it cool if Tom Lawler rolls around? And it was like, met the guy, seemed super nice dude. And he basically had a basic background of professional wrestling, because I guess that's where what he learned first in Florida. But he hadn't done professional wrestling in 6, 7 maybe 10 years, because everything was concentrated on the MMA. So I remember we were having some small school shows and we got Tom involved, and, you know, we try to keep it very safe for him, very, you know, we wanted to showcase him but not expose him in any way.
Right.
And he had a couple of small matches with us. Then all of a sudden he was like, oh yeah, I got this booking. I'm wrestling Kyle O'Reilly and I'm wrestling Bobby Fish and I'm wrestling Adam Cole. Because they saw this UFC guy. Now all of a sudden, when he was working for us for pretty much nothing just to get experience, he got paid big money, like, without really getting that experience back. Like, he hadn't wrestled in years, wrestled a couple of matches, and now they're putting him over the Ring of Honor stars and everybody else. And in no time, Tom Lawler became like a main guy in independent wrestling. And it was like, wow, we were babying him, I guess. But he's a guy, when we did our Natural Born Killer show, he had maybe the best match on the card both times.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, he was able to adjust. He worked Douglas James in the first one. Oh, he didn't do the second one. My bad. I think he was getting ready for an MMA fight. But Tom has really, you know, you can say Matt Riddle. We used him once, and he seems to have, you know, Tom and Riddle are basically more popular as wrestlers than they were as MMA fighters.
Yeah. Do you think
– And my side
– Yeah, Tom, who do you think?
Yeah, I'll pitch in. My side, there was only one pro wrestler who did well in MMA and kickboxing, Sylvester Trakai, that I've ever been around. He was a 2-time NCAA wrestling champion. I think his only loss was to Kurt Angle in preparations for the Olympics.
Yeah.
So he was a big, mean, tough guy, and he fought with me through all of our time at K1. Matter of fact, I took a loss to one guy in particular, Christophe Mido, and then he had to fight him on his next fight, and he just almost broke the guy's back. And he comes back. He comes backstage afterwards. He says, "I got him for you, buddy." Like he
did it for you.
He got revenge for me. So yeah, that guy is as tough as nails. He was in WWE for a bit. But the three other guys that are very interesting would be Mark Kerr, the Smashing Machine. Kevin Randleman, the monster Kevin Randleman, who's no longer with us, and Mark Coleman. I trained all three of those guys for a bit here in the States and then worked with them in Japan for Inoki. So they always wanted me to team with these guys because they wanted to have a pro wrestler who could shoot as well as a shooter that, you know, I could kind of fill in for him. So tag teaming with Mark Kerr, that was a rough one. That was when he was going through some rougher times. Kevin Randleman, such a natural. He was amazing. And Mark Coleman, they all did a pretty substantial runs in wrestling in Japan, pro wrestling, as well as, of course, pride fighting.
I remember because of them, that's when they were talking about WCW bringing in the Fight Club faction that I still want to use. But it was based off Kerr, Coleman, and a couple other guys that never came to fruition. And I've always kept that in my back pocket.
That makes sense. Makes a lot of sense.
With that is like Lawler, I think Tom Lawler, one of the reasons he just, you know, was able to explode is because he has the gift of gab. I mean, he is a great.
Well, he definitely has a great personality. While you look on the other hand, you know, Matt Riddle's bro this and bro that, not like the best promo guy. Like I remember with Lawler, on the first Mecca, when it was When Stars Collide, he was actually our color guy. And he just basically studied a lot of Japanese wrestling. And I was shocked because he was pulling these moves out of his ass like, holy shit. Like, he knew his stuff. Like, I was not aware that he was such a diehard wrestling fan. And, you know, good for him. Now, you know, he's had quite a successful run in MLW. And, you know, we're trying to utilize it more. It's like, that's kind of like a hidden gem. Like if you asked me, hey, Joe, you know, who's the guy that you'd like to use? And it's like probably more so like a Tom Lawler just because he is local. Yeah. And, you know, being that we worked with him and helped him out, he gives us a better deal than he would a different promoter because, you know, he trained with us. So it's good to get guys like that that are good to you. And that's the one thing we try to strive for is having that good locker room to where, you know, half the crowd don't think – half the people in the back are like, oh, that guy's an asshole or, oh, he's big leaguing us, which I remember they said – a bunch of the kids said the very first show when we had Modest. And the kids were like, yeah, he didn't even come up to us. And it was like, what? Like, you're supposed to go up to him. Hello, sir. Can I take your seat, sir? I remember Jimmy Superfly Snuka was here, and these young kids wouldn't even get up out of their seat to give a 65-year-old man a chair.
Wow. You know,
I can bury the kids all day.
You know, speaking of kids, you know, we're talking Lacey, who is, you know, just so spectacular in how she's developed. Going back to UPW, Tom, who was a standout female for you? Was it someone like Lisa Marie or, you know, was there some other female wrestler who maybe never got the opportunity?
Yeah, I have a funny story with Lisa Marie, or Victoria, as she was known in WWE. So I lived in Hesperia, California, and my next door neighbor tells me his younger sister is a cheerleader in college and doing fitness contests. And so he brings her up and I meet her, and she's gorgeous at the time, you know, and turns out her name's Lisa Marie. So years later, she got, I believe her friend, maybe Stacy Keebler, one of her friends from the fitness business, tells her to come to UPW. So she walks in and she's like, Tom? And I'm like, whoa, Bob's sister. So I got to train with her. Another funny thing, we got cast for a commercial and we actually had to help with the production. And it was her and myself, and then I cast my buddy Hank Hill for Planned Parenthood. So we did a Planned Parenthood commercial. We were like wrestling each other, putting each other in headlocks, and then telling people to wear condoms. I don't know. I still don't know what any of it had to do with each other, but it was a paycheck. So I reminded her of that when I saw her not long ago. So anyway, that's Lisa Marie. she was a talent, like a genuine athlete. We had the Cassandra, who came from a fight background, sadist. Yeah. She was a good wrestler, but she didn't have enough wrestling knowledge from the past to, like, a lot of times if you didn't grow up as a fan, you just don't get psychology wise. And she wanted to go out and, like, think it was a fight. So that she had look wise one of the best, but didn't quite have the psychology. We had Looney Lane,
yeah,
who was part of the Discovery Channel. She looked good. She was young, but didn't ever really get the time in. We had Savvy, who was another athlete, a dancer. So, we had a few. I can't say anyone in particular stood out more than Lisa Marie, just because of the total package.
Yeah.
Of course, she went on to do, I don't know, 10 years in WWE, maybe 15. I don't know how long.
Yeah, she had a real good run.
Yeah. And between that and TNA, too, she was at TNA for a good 5 to 7 years. So.
Exactly.
Now that's a great, I'm glad you said that about her being an athlete. One of the reasons I think she had a longevity to her career is because of the fact that she was so fit. I mean, talk about a just person built like that perfectly for the ring. Is that something that you emphasize? And Joe, same thing. Do you guys, kind of ingrain it in the kids that if you're going to be successful, you have to think longevity wise. So you have to take care of your body as a temple, or else, you're going to lose your career quickly.
Well, as a promoter of a show, I prefer Vandegrift and Damian Drake to do their high risk stuff. Obviously be as safe as possible, but that's what's going to get them to that next level.
Yeah.
They're wrestling in AAA now because they take a lot of risks, and with the and learn and doing that lucha style is a lot of high flying. So in some cases you want it to happen, but you just want it to be safely done and not overdone, because sometimes that's all people have is, how many suicide dives you're going to do in a match. It's like, I think it's boring the first time. I see guys do it 3 or 4 times in a match. It's like you crumple, you hit the guardrail. It's like it doesn't even look like it's a very impactful move.
Right.
Especially now when guys are doing somersaults off the top rope, or they're running and doing these crazy flips. Like the suicide dive is a move that I thought would have died years ago,
Well,
I would say no. I do not want to discourage people from being who they are.
Yeah.
And then I'll pitch in my 2 cents. When you talk about fitness in general, Vince always had, or New York, WWE always had what they call the airport test, and that is if you see a guy walk through the airport and everyone stops and says, "Who is that guy?" That's who they want to hire for pro wrestlers. Whatever that makes. Obviously, you got to look like an athlete or look like a, some larger than life character, whatever it is. So you're seeing more and more now people that are smaller, a lot of 5'9" or, under 200 pound guys. So in order to make up for the difference of not looking so extraordinary, they're obviously doing higher flying moves, higher risk moves, and, adding like parkour into pro wrestling, which I'm a huge fan of. But it's a combination, I'd say, of whatever you can do to make yourself larger than life, and then obviously making the high flying stuff make sense, be safe, and still fit in within the realm of good psychology. Because that is one thing that obviously when we watch a lot of the matches today, what we teach psychology here pretty heavy, especially here from the ground up, because we talk about the 7 or 8 steps of psychology, and if you don't understand the fundamentals there, then you're building a house on poor foundation. So from there, if you can figure out how to fit these fancy moves into good storytelling, then they have a lot of meaning. If you're just doing stuff to do it, obviously, then you can real quickly watch the audience's eyes glaze over when yeah. It doesn't make sense and it's just put in there to gratuitously get your shit in, as they say.
I have a lot of conversations with a lot of the younger guys who, they feel not being used enough. They're not getting on enough shows. And I take numerous ones into the office, and the conversation's basically the same. And I let them know, just because you can do the move doesn't mean anything. It's like, people need to genuinely give a shit about what you're doing. And that's what the biggest issue is with the inexperienced wrestlers. You've had 10, 20, 30 matches. They don't have a character. Yeah. They don't have a gimmick. They don't have a promo. So they're going to rely on doing a cool move. But what does the cool move mean in the long term? It's like, people need to genuinely care about what you're doing, and that's what you need to focus more on. Because, as I try to tell them, just because you can do a cooler move than the other guy, well, look at the other guy. He doesn't do – Disco Inferno doesn't do any cool moves, but Disco Inferno will get more heat than pretty much everybody in our locker room. And I'm not talking about 20 years ago in his prime. I'm talking about at almost 50 years old.
Yeah.
Because he knows how to get the fans to hate his guts. He does such a good job of it, they hate him on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, people want to kill the dude because of his Twitter comments. You think he doesn't know exactly what he's saying all the time to basically garner a thought from somebody, like, oh, this guy's an asshole. Oh, I can't stand this guy. You know, and he pits the guys that people like, the Conans, the Lance Storms, and basically he is the heel. He's not trying to get the cool heel heat. He's trying to get, you're a dick, and I want somebody to beat the fuck out of you.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what happens. We got a couple guys here, you know, they're playing heels. They're smarmy heels that are basically chicken shit heels. But somehow in the match, they're doing their three-move combination with the super kick and the Superman punch and all the others. And then they're getting their ass beat. And it's like, well, you shouldn't even be doing those super cool moves. Because if I see people doing super cool moves, just like the fans, you start to like people.
Yep.
You know, it's like with Damian Drake, at times we've had conversations. And it's like, don't not do the stuff you're good at because you're portraying yourself as the heel. You know, do something heelish, but you still have to do the things that you're good at, because at this level, you're trying to get to the next level. You're trying to get to WWE and AEW. And if you send a whole bunch of matches of you just, you know, taking heat and kicking and punching, nobody's going to look at you that way.
Right.
So even though I want to see certain things in a match, we have to give the freedom, because they're all still in a learning process. When they get to WWE, they could tell them what they need them to do. And here, I'm not trying to hold anybody back, because they need to have that opportunity to get better and better and better. So certain things that you might not do in the big leagues, you know, even though we consider ourselves a pretty big company, it's a totally different situation. And it's working storylines, and it's working angles, and, you know, not everything's about the wrestling moves, you know. Like I said, pretty much Tom will tell you, most people, you know, 90% of the stuff, everybody does the same. And then there's the 10% of maybe the big guys doing the power stuff and the smaller guys. And then you have the guys that stand out, like when a Sean O'Hare used to go up top and do the Shauntan bomb. You know, it was a big deal. You didn't see a guy that size doing it. You know, with us, Sepa Fatu is the same way. You know, he's as agile as his brother, the Usos, except he's a little bigger than the Usos. The Usos are smaller. You expect them to fly, while Sepa's a great combination of power and the speed. So he needs to utilize that at all times, because he never knows who's watching. He needs to show everybody what he's capable of doing.
Yeah. And Tom, I'm glad you brought up the seven steps, because that's one thing that I've never forgotten. And is that something that you find that those who are learning from you, if they can absorb that and realize that those steps are basically your blueprint to what a match should look like, and, you know, is that one of the keys for getting guys signed, basically, is to know how matches are done and really, you know, sprinkle in the incredible move here and there, but really that fundamental base is, for lack of a better word, storytelling at its best.
Yeah, if you, anyone who's studied Hollywood screenplay writing, if you watch a movie and you just, a lot of times you won't necessarily understand they're using the psychology and they actually have a formula or a recipe. At the end, you're just going to say, I don't know why, but that movie was just good. It hit me. It pulled emotions out of me. It told the story well. Well, so a wrestling match foundation-wise does the same thing. You know, as far as the basic steps, obviously, when we call out the basic seven steps or eight steps, we always base it on heel and face, heel being the bad guy, face being the good guy. And so if you always – if you want – you sometimes – you could go face-face. Sometimes you could go heel-heel. But either way, just understanding the basic beginning is that we have to establish establish who's who and what's what. And then, of course, we want to see the face, what we call the face outshine, where the face gets his opportunity to really look great. And then that kind of pisses off the heel, and then the heel hits the cutoff. And then the heel goes into the beatdown. The face almost gets his hope spot. And then we set up for the big fiery comeback, when then we go into the near falls, and then we go into think back. Those of you who aren't familiar with those steps, per se, think back throughout history of any good wrestling match you've seen. Maybe not any good match, because it's changed quite a bit. But foundationally, that's how it works. And so, one of the main reasons that I'm big on it is I spent many years, including when I was first on the development with WWE, not ever having that explained to me or ever having it broken down. And it's like, how much easier would have life been? Because first of all, you don't want to go out there and have to memorize all the moves. If you do, it looks like you're memorizing moves and it looks like you're doing what's next. And so the question there becomes, well, how do you know what's next? Okay, I know what's next because we're in, okay, we got 10 minutes. In the first, you know, in the first couple of minutes of that, we know what's going to happen. We're establishing. So, you know, if we don't, we don't need to talk about what's going to happen right there. We can keep it pretty loose, but we know that the heel's kind of getting, you know, out wrestled or, you know, outshined, and the face is getting shined up, and then that's pissing the heel off, and then he gets his. So anyway, you get the idea. It allows you to go out and wrestle and listen to the fans, but still understand where you're supposed to be. Because you understand the blueprint.
Yeah. That's well said.
I second that.
Well, I was just going to say, Joe, do you recognize those steps? Do you recognize when someone is really good at storytelling, and do you encourage them to use that skill as opposed to just kind of you know, someone who might go out there and just do shine spots, you might want to bring them in, but does that fundamental really catch your eye from you being a fan growing up to being a promoter?
I would probably say no, because when we first started and we were looking for talent, because we had no pool. We had no wrestling schools in town. There was no local wrestling. I knew of some people who had worked for Rush before. So my job was to be like, keep up with who was popular in the SoCal area, for example. In Arizona, like I said, when we hooked up with, say, Navajo and that crew. So when we started FSW and we did the very first show, there was a team called the Young Bucks, and they looked pretty good. Now, especially in 2009, nobody was going to confuse the Young Bucks with a team that was telling stories. They were going to do some super cool shit that the crowd was going to pop for, and there was a combination of guys. Like, one of the main guys we were going to use was Derek Nykerk, who had, you know, a cup of coffee in WWE. He was part of Heyman Security when one of the Basham brothers was released. Derek took the role for the ECW show. And he was just this, you know, big country boy, former baseball player. He was just like a mean dude. And when it came to him, he was more of a storyteller, and he was a guy that we were going to utilize at the top of the card with a guy like Kenny King,
right,
who had basically known the business. He was working down at I forgot the name of the company before Ring of Honor, which was down in Florida, which the Gabe guy ran there, and that's how Kenny got into Ring of Honor. Right. F something W or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And when we're looking at guys, you're generally not watching a 15-minute match to see the beginning, middle, and the end of the story. Right. You're looking at guys and seeing if they can get a crowd reaction, you know, do they even know how to lock up? Because, you know, back in the day before that, we really ran FSW and we did that Vegas Extreme. We would get VHS HTEP tapes of like all these guys, and you would see some of these guys was the shits. Like I said, there was one guy, he ran a company. I forgot who it was, but in the match, he wrestled Frankie Kazarian. And Kazarian at the time was, it's 99, 2000. So he's got some really good independent following in SoCal. Right. And now he wrestles this guy, and Kazarian's basically giving him a clinic. And all of a sudden, the guy out of nowhere kind of ends up rolling him up and beats him. And it's like, well, it's the guy's company, but the guy was the shits. And you could tell, it's like, despite that this guy was getting a lot of the offense, when he got the offense, it was like, this is brutal. And you could tell Kazarian by far is a way better wrestler. So I guess subconsciously I'm looking at it and saying, well, this guy's doing this, that, and the other thing, which is probably because of the psychology. But at the time, I'm not thinking of psychology because I'm just watching a match. When I watched Macho Man and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, which was basically a nine-month story from the broken larynx with the bell to WrestleMania, they took a 20-minute match and made it a nine-month storyline, and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat got taken off television because he had the crushed larynx, and that was telling a whole different story. That was telling, like, you know, three movies. And when you're watching it, you're not thinking of, like, wow, this is like Hollywood, how they're doing the beginning. As you grow older and you learn and you get more experience, then that's when you start to see things differently. You know, and now as a promoter, I generally rely on trusted wrestlers who are not driven by, hey, I got this idea about myself. They're always looking to better the situation that they're in. That's why I work with Remy Marcel a lot, because he'll watch certain guys and tell me what he thinks of this guy and what might work there. So it's the same thing when I bring in, you know, a guy out of California like Brian Cage, and he recommends somebody to me, I'm going to take a much deeper look than the 50 random emails I'll get a month from people that most of the time they're nowhere near ready. You know, I won't say they suck. I'll just say they're very inexperienced and they have a long way to go. Yeah. And I don't have enough time to go look at everything. So I'm going to rely on people. Same thing at the school. When I'm here, but I'm doing business. I'm handling other stuff.
Right.
You know, it's going to be Tom and it's going to be Sin and it's going to be Kenny. Like, hey, bro, you know, this kid's only been doing it for 5 months. You need to keep your eye on him. He's really shining head and shoulders above these other guys. And then when we're looking for somebody for the student showcase, which is the Future Shock show, and we're trying to give some opportunities to the kids who've never had a match, well, that's the first place they're generally going to have a match.
Right.
And I'm going to rely on my trainers to tell me, hey, they think this guy's ready. Hey, this guy, his offense ain't the best, but if you need somebody to put somebody over, this guy is going to sell his ass off. And the best guys start off by selling their ass off, looking good, and then getting a little bit more and a little bit more. You know, Kevin Cross might be the exception, but Chris Bay probably didn't win a match for his first 6 months. Yeah. His job was to go in there and make somebody else look good. And the more he made somebody look good, then he started getting some offense. Then it was like, well, I think we can invest in this guy, and then he's going to start getting wins. And that's where it all, you know, breaks down to, because we're lucky enough that we're the wrestling school and the promotion.
Right.
So we don't have to go searching for green kids and hope that this guy puts on a good match. We know who's capable and we know what they need them to do because they were going to be in here and they've been doing it for months and months and months.
All right, Tom, I'm going to rattle off some names. Just kind of give me some thoughts on these guys. First one, and it was Full Impact Pro that Kenny wrestled with before Ring of Honor. Kenny also wrestled for UPW. What was he like back then? Because he was still kind of young.
I don't remember Kenny King at UPW, to be honest with you. But if he did...
I think he did, because I know he was talking about Baby Slim and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I you know, I believe that might have been... So near the end, I was in Japan almost full time.
Okay, right.
Because, yeah, we was doing a 0-1. So I'm pretty sure he came right at the end, and I'm pretty sure that was when I was in Japan. So I don't really have an opinion there, although he's a big fan of his work today.
Yeah, I remember Kenny also got a PWG show where he broke Brian Cage's jaw. Nice. And I think he was never asked back again.
The Miz, were you still overseas during Miz's training?
No, I was there. I was there for a bit of it. Not so much the training, but seeing him come into the shows. I feel a little bad about how we treated him, because we originally, when he came in, he was from the MTV shows, and so rather, and then he had a bit of a cocky, you know, character, and of course he'd play the character, and I think people were having trouble distinguishing the character from the actual person. The person, Mike Mizanin, is actually a very nice guy, and you know, it's funny, because once people go off and become stars, it's always interesting to see who will put you over and speak highly of you. And he's one who's always done that. So it's greatly appreciated. Rick and I have always appreciated that. But at the UPW shows, we would have him do matches with the smallest guys and go out and get beat up. We'd have him get smashed into lockers. It's kind of like the butt of most every joke back then, because, you know, we were playing off the fact that he was a MTV guy that wanted to be a wrestler. And sure enough, he, you know, went on to be, has his own show on E. So he, you know, he's one guy. John Cena, that was obvious. You know, we all knew he was going to be a star. Miz, I didn't see it at all. And I told him that, you know, I said, I feel bad that I treated him nicely, but you know, I didn't ever think that he was going to make it. So you don't like go above and beyond when you think a guy's just here for, you know, 3 months and then he's going to go off to do something else.
Even when he made it to WWE, I remember like, wow, they're really holding John Morrison back, putting him with this bum. Yeah. Like, oh, really? This is what Morrison's got to get? And for a while, the Miz became one of the most enjoyable guys for me to watch.
Yeah.
And he's a guy that, you know, I say to all these young kids, you know, some are smaller, some may be overweight. It's not the best athlete. It's the guy who has the most heart and who's got the drive to be the best. If you have the drive to do it, there's a lot of people who just come in here and they coast and they think, hey, I'm a big dude, I'm going to do that. Kevin Cross didn't get where he got because he was just a big guy. He got there because he spent hours a day in the mirror cutting promos and knowing his character. And he was in great shape when we met him and when he first started training. Now he's in exceptional shape.
Yeah.
Chris Bay is the same way. You know, he was 140, 150 pounds. Now he might only be 170, but he's all muscle. And, you know, he'll deadlift the guy 220 pounds over his head. He's like one of the strongest small guys that I know.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you work hard, you know, we had a kid with Asperger's. Like, oh, there's no way this guy's ever, you know, I'm going to be the next John Cena. And it's like, bro, you're lucky if you're ever going to ref a match. But he outlasted guys twice his size because he had the heart and desire to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the great thing about the wrestling business, especially today, where you don't have to look like Batista to be a star.
Yeah.
You know, Adam Cole's like 5'5", 5'6". And, you know, I've heard numerous people, Regal, Triple H, that if Adam Cole was 6'1", he'd probably be the WWE champion multiple times by now.
Yeah.
So, and he still has a great career ahead of him, except that he is just so much smaller that if you throw him in a match with Brock Lesnar, it's kind of hard to justify, you know, Adam Cole whooping Brock Lesnar's ass. Yeah. Now, Drew McIntyre is a totally different thing. He's a big boy, you know, but it took Drew forever to get there. Hard work.
Yeah. Speaking of hard work and body shapes that weren't the style at the time. Samoa Joe. Tom, did you know from Joe's passion that he would eventually make it to WWE? Or did you realize that it would be, you know, a long road ahead, because even at that time at UPW, you know, like a guy like Steven Regal would come in and he would see Joe's talent and he would maybe suggest it, but they were really down on the body type. Is that just that evolution, or, you know, what brings it around that, so guys who are in that kind of boat don't get discouraged?
Yeah, so Samoa Joe, anyone who's seen the training video that I did years ago with John Cena, Samoa Joe, Frankie Kazarian, Chris Daniels, and others, if you could Google it online and see the shape that Samoa Joe was in, he wasn't horribly coordinated then either. His bumps weren't clean. He was just kind of falling over. So he didn't have, there was no writing that said Samoa Joe was going to be anything at all. Matter of fact, if anything, it didn't look good at all for him. However, as soon as he actually started to perform, he grew up in a Polynesian dance troupe, and he just knew how to perform. His timing was really good, and the moves were never crisp. This is in the early, early days. And then eventually, when I first got my shot to go to Japan for Hashimoto, to go do a main event against Hashimoto, you know, they came to Japan and filmed me practicing, and Samoa Joe happened to be one of the guys who showed up. And he was a big fan of Japan, and kind of not forced his way, but, you know, weaseled his way into being sure he was doing all the spots with me in front of them. And then they ended up booking him to come over and have a match early on the card and be in my corner for the first match. And then from there, he's a good politician. He's a very likable guy. And he worked his way into being invited over on the regular basis to Japan. And then from there, the combination of having good timing and politicking worked his way up to, you know, higher up the card to where you know, he got to be a pretty respected guy over there. So from there, did I think he'd be in WWE? No. Matter of fact, they made it pretty clear that Vince did not want those type of people in WWE. It was the same with Kia Stevens, for example. What does she go by? Kong, Amazing Kong. Yeah. One of my good friends from Japan, great person. You know, that she has stories of Jim Ross telling her, I believe it was on a TV show or something, where telling her that she's not what WWE is looking for. And Samoa Joe had exactly that same thing happen. And they became so good that they became undeniable. Yep. Kia Stevens or Amazing Kong did the same thing, to the point where they were pretty much begging them. You know, they became two of the top talents in wrestling because they just put in the time, wouldn't take no for an answer, and kept going, kept the nose to the grindstone.
You know, it's crazy to think that, because I remember many years ago, Mick Foley was putting over Samoa Joe,
yep,
and AJ Styles, and it's like the success that they had that nobody expected. Imagine if AJ and Joe had a 10, 12, 15-year run in WWE, like the popularity. You know, AJ Styles possibly could have been bigger than John Cena, mm, if the Fed had any interest in looking at him. Like, even I was shocked that the response he got from the Rumble, because when he first came out, like, oh, they're bringing AJ up to the main roster. It's like, figure he's going to have to change his name and start in NXT. And it was guys like AJ Styles that made WWE stop making people change their names. Yeah. Because before that, Daniel Bryan had to be changed. And then Joe came in and got his name. And now everybody gets their names and works at NXT. And I think that's all because of the success AJ Styles gave him. You know, obviously Vince has the copyrights of the names now and stuff and making the money. But we always thought it was weird seeing these guys have to change their name, because to us they were so hugely successful.
Right.
Like, you know, what are they going to call Samoa Joe? You know, Polynesian Pete? You know what I mean?
I like Polynesian Pete. That's a great name.
We'll change Hero Lou's name to Polynesian Pete.
one of the guys that was at UPW, and you know, it's just a shame that you know his life went this way. But Mike Bell, do you have any recollections of Mike in terms of, you know, him and Smelly, and just what their relationship was like to UPW and to Rick and yourself?
Yeah, so there's three brothers. Chris Bell, the filmmaker, he's the one who did all the documentaries, Bigger, Stronger, Faster, Kratom documentary, Pill documentary, Steroid documentary. Smelly Bell, who's now, we jokingly call him the Meathead Millionaire. He's very famous in the powerlifting industry, and he owns a supplement brand, among other things, and has a successful podcast. And the third brother, who was the original older one, was, of course, Mad Dog. He was a what we call enhancement talent or jobber for WWE, and he was a very good jobber. He knew how to go out. He could take charge in a match. He was a ring general, but he knew his role because of his size and the way he looked. So he would help us teach. He brought in his brothers. Chris got involved in production, helping us out tremendously there. Smelly, of course, I think he was probably one of our heavyweight champions. He was for a fact. And, at that point, wrestling used to be a lot different. Very, 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 very different. And it was kind of like an old boys network. Drugs were very much part of the scene because of the travel schedule. And so he was part of that kind of old guard where it was still kind of cool to do, you know, pills and different things. And so, unfortunately, in his situation, if you have that addictive personality, it's not something you can just turn off. Nowadays, one of the things I'm most grateful for is the fact that the guys don't party like rock stars. Back in the day, it was a rock star job, 100% rock star job. You somehow pulled yourself together to do your match, but the rest of the time was pretty crazy with the travel and everything that happened after that. So he unfortunately came in under that guard, didn't have the ability to turn it off, and then of course he ended up passing away. But he was a real good dude.
Yeah. I have fond memories of the Bell family, and that's, it's a shame. Joe, is there anyone that was on the independent scene that you tried to go after in like 2009, 2010, as you were starting up, that you just, for whatever reason, missed and couldn't get?
Well, initially, when we were first looking to do the show, as I said, we were scouting around. There was a guy who we eventually used on a frequent basis, Ryan Taylor, for example. Ryan actually trained at UPW also.
Yes.
And Taylor was a guy who we were looking at, because at that point, you know, SoCal Uncensored was kind of a big deal in California. So we posted, hey, Vegas company, they're looking, you know, we're looking for some new talent, blah, 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 blah. So there was a crew out of San Diego, which was SoCal Crazy, Chimera, who became Del Rio's, I guess, Jesus or whatever he's called, Ricardo Rodriguez.
Yeah.
He wore a mask, and I always remember he was like this chubby guy who did a lot of high-flying stuff in a mask. And we had booked them on the show. They canceled last minute. Mm. Taylor, I remember, was like, hey, we agreed on a price. And then he was like, oh, my local company, can you give me like $10 more? And I'm like, well, if I give you $10 more, who's to say a week later you're not going to say to give you another $10 more? So I was like, hey, this is the pay. This is our first show. We can see after that. So we didn't use him on the first show. Brandon Gatson, who I liked a lot, he had a gymnastics background. His brother won a medal in the Olympics, and he was like a little child star on Star Search, Brandon Gatson. that we ended up eventually using down the line. I remember trying to get Alcatraz the first time, and he was done. He had moved from San Diego, but then he told the story about how I ran into him at the Thomas and Mack, and he said I gave him a great pitch, and that's how we got Alcatraz on board at FSW, and he became, you know, one of our biggest stars and helped put over the next champion after Tyshawn Prince won the belt off him in the steel cage, which to this day, you know, could be the biggest show that we ever did.
Tom, at UPW, Rick also liked to do the booking for, you know, like you said, submissions for auditions and whatnot. Do you remember who else went on an audition for Manhunter that Cena got? Because that was like John's first Hollywood exposure, was doing that Manhunter competition show.
Yeah, I don't recall. No, I Cena's the only one that I remember who did that. I know Stefan Gamlin. Well, we had a bunch of different interesting people there that did those type of shows. Stefan Gamlin went and did one. What was it called? Oh, God, that's catching me off guard. I don't know. And then, of course, we had a bunch of the American Gladiator guys train with us.
Right.
But no, I don't recall the one with Cena, the Manhunter.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because I wondered, I thought at that time you might have actually auditioned for it. But I don't remember. Yeah. Okay. And one other question. She now lives here and is with Sabu. What was Melissa Coates like at UPW?
She was a real famous bodybuilder. You know, she was a cover of all the magazines. And she didn't have a ton of wrestling experience, but I just saw her not that long ago. And she's always been a sweetheart and always worked hard. And so, yeah, she's now with Sabu and still in the business somehow. But, real brief time with her. Most of the bodybuilders, as I said before, I worked with some of the highest level bodybuilders in the world, and a lot of them had trouble just running the ropes. The very nature of what you do to your body to become a bodybuilder does not generally translate well into pro wrestling.
Yeah.
So you had guys pulling hamstrings almost immediately, blowing up, you know, really bad. Melissa, I think, did better than most, and she, the one thing she did is stuck it out. So yeah, that's how she's still, you know, is somehow in the business.
As we kind of wrap up here, Joe, what are you looking forward to in terms of what Tom brings to the school? And are you noticing anything in some of the talent who have been around Tom now for about a month in terms of maybe the way that people are responding or kind of, you know, clicking a little bit more?
Well, I think that would be more of a question for him because, like I said, I'm in and out watching. Like yesterday, Tom was here early for the beginners, and some of those beginners are 2 or 3 weeks in, and we got a few that are a month or two in. And I'm pretty sure Tom can say there's a couple of them because we have some big athletic kids that have come in, and, you know, obviously it's very early, but you can always pinpoint who you think's going to last. Who you think, hey, you know, this guy might be a valuable asset. I think this guy is going to put in the work, or he already is putting in the work. Like I see a couple of the younger guys, the Moses kid, you know, he's been here probably the longest now. He's been here a good 3 months, and he's a guy that seems to get it, has an athletic background. That's always going to help. It's a theater background, an athletic background, martial arts, boxing. That means you've already conditioned yourself to do things. You know, sure, there's a lot of guys who just love wrestling and they're not athletic at all, and they can be hugely successful in this. But it probably will take them a little bit longer because guys, they're in jiu-jitsu, they kind of know how to do some of the roles, if it's a judo role. So it's kind of getting that same thing. And, you know, I know with Tom teaching – compared to some of the other guys, I'm also the same way. I like to get these guys going. You know, we want them to excel as quick as possible.
Right.
You know, a Chris Bay got his first match 3 or 4 months in. You know, that was probably unheard of back when Tom was training, you know what I mean? And because at that point, a lot of the schools, you know, they're charging you X amount of dollars and they want to make sure they get that money. While nowadays it's, you know, guys are only going to pay monthly dues and some are just going to try it because they think they want to be the next Rock or John Cena. And after a month or two, they're like, wow, this fucking hurts. I don't want to do this. And, you know, like I said, it's the guys that you see. There's certain beginners that you see once or twice here and there. And there's the guys that are consistently here 3 or 4 times a week. Who do you think is going to be the one that advances the most?
Yeah.
It's obviously the guy who's going to put in the most time. It's like, hey, class starts at 5. He's here at 4:30 stretching. Class ends at 8 because the trainer left, but he stuck around because a couple of advanced guys were here till 9, you know. And those are the guys that I would put my money on. Because they seem dedicated, they seem, you know, relentless in what they're trying to do. And, you know, like I said, I was in and out yesterday, but Tom's watching. He's doing some drills. We had a kid who just started. What I saw the first day, Tom wanted him to do something. And that was great. He was eager. He was excited. And he wanted to do it. But it was like he didn't really know how to do it. So let's not take time away from the class. And what was great about Tom was he was like, hey, you know, I appreciate it and stuff, but let's get somebody in there who can do it. Because the worst thing you can do is bog down the class.
Yeah.
And just like in the beginner class, Tom's not going to be like, hey, guys, talk it over. We want you guys to have an 8-minute match. You know, most of those guys' answer should be, are you sure? We don't even know how to lock up yet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I guarantee you if he tells them, hey, guys, put together a 5-minute match. They'll go over there and they'll try to do a bad backyard 5-minute match because they just want to wrestle. So you have to basically keep them from themselves.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're going to want to drop Macho Man. I know I would want to drop a Macho Man elbow off the top rope, especially with the giant pad that we have. But they'll do it without the pad and break their elbow. And guess what? Not only do they stop training, they stop paying for 6 months.
Yeah.
And then after 6 months, they're like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. So as a business, you're trying to juggle all the areas. So, you know, and with Tom is good because he's a guy who can train the beginners, the intermediates, the advanced. And, you know, obviously guys like Daivari, I'm pretty sure guys like Tom, Sin, they would prefer to be working with the advanced guys because they know a lot what to do. You can kind of critique things. You can have matches. But to me, the most important thing is having a guy who could train the guys who don't know what they're doing in the beginners.
Right.
You know, I know a lot of times they'll say some of our younger guys, roster guys, well, they'll be good treating the beginners. I kind of disagree because they don't know from scratch how to be a superstar, how to get signed, how to get all this information. Again, sure, they can teach you how to do roles. But I always differentiate. I always say there's running a class and there's teaching a class.
Right.
And those are two separate things. And it's like, oh, I can't believe you have him running the class. And it'll be one of the younger guys who's on the roster. And it's like you're misinterpreting what it is. It's running the class. He's taking what the normal trainer would do and you do your rolls and you run the ropes. He's not teaching you a new way to do an arm bar or a hammer lock.
Right.
He's not teaching you new things. He's basically showing you guys and trying to get you to repetitively do the same thing over and over. And guys like Tom and guys like Sin and Kenny and TJ Perkins, they all offer something a little different, you know, which is the best part of it, because you got TJ who's a cruiserweight guy and you got Tom who was an MMA fighter and more of a heavyweight. I saw a couple of those drop kicks back in the day, you know, and it's a little bit of everything. So, you know, it's a good opportunity for everybody to learn all different aspects because we have it all.
Yeah. And Tom, as we wrap up, what are your feelings about just kind of getting back into it and how things have been going?
Oh, it's been fun. So yeah, I got back involved because of Lacey Ryan. I started training her about 8 years ago, and then we heard about the scene here in Vegas and moved out here from Texas, and met Joe. I mean, kind of knew of them, but we reunited. And then I travel for a living. Generally, I'm on a plane Monday and come home Friday, or I have to leave the country as well for my real job. So with the invent of the COVID, I've been fortunate to be able to be here, and it's been great, because I think you don't realize how significant something like wrestling is in your life at a certain point. I just decided I had to walk away because I got to a certain age and opened a gym and was getting ready to take the next step of my life and join, become a productive member of society. And so at that point, it was kind of painful to still be around wrestling. But I realized that one of my favorite things of wrestling was always teaching. And so the fact that I could be of assistance in helping people, you know, attempt to achieve their goals is hugely rewarding. So that's what I love about it, and just the fact that these are really good people here, because needless to say, there's not all that many good promoters out there or good wrestling schools out there. So when you find one that's on the same level as what you were doing with UPW, but it's progressed and it's now to the next level, it was just like so great to get involved and be fit in to the family.
That's awesome. I, I'm very much looking forward to seeing, you know, how people progress. You know, the fact that you're able to still get a chance to communicate stuff is wonderful, and can't say enough. The only thing now that I want to see is get that crash pad out, and I want to see Joe take the Macho Man elbow. Let's get that done, Joe.
I'm going to save that till I win the FSW Heavyweight Championship, to be honest. You know, I'm not going to pull that out until it really matters. You know, under the tutelage of Tom, I'm going to take out Rocky T and win the heavyweight title, just like Vince Russo.
And I have a feeling he may go out like Ram, what's his name? Ram the
Randy the Ram.
Randy the Ram. Joe might just go out like Randy the Ram, just make that his last big dive.
Awesome. Well, everyone, thank you for listening. Remember, tune into the DeFalco Files every Wednesday, and please support FSW Future Stars Wrestling. Check them out online. Check them out on Fight TV, on Twitch, on YouTube. And don't forget to download and listen and subscribe and tell your friends about the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. And until next week, we want to remind you that the DeFalco Files are definitely the show to listen to, because the truth is here. Thank you, everybody.